5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Ladies and gentlemen of the AFN, this is the White House in Washington calling. I present the President of the United States.
I appreciate this opportunity to extend my greetings and best wishes to the Convention of the Alaska Federation of Navies. I want you to be among the first to know that I have just signed the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. This is a milestone in Alaska's history.
The corporate whale, ANCSA, the first 10 years.
The Reverend Merkulieff from St. George Island.
This land of Alaska, which thou gave to our ancestors who had come and gone before us, is now being handed to us a second time by the act of the United States Congress and our untiring efforts. A second chance is given to us by thee to be the new custodians and caretakers.
With the passage of the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act on December 18, 1971, Alaska's nearly 52,000 Indians, Eskimos, and Aleuts were to become custodians of 44 million acres of land and extinguish all Aboriginal claims to the rest of the state. A state with approximately 375 million acres all told. But those 44 million acres in fee simple title, one-ninth of all lands in the state, represents more land than is held in trust for all other American Indians. And the monetary compensation is nearly four times the total won by Indian tribes from the Indian Claims Commission. In the 10 years since President Nixon signed the act into law, less than one half of the land guaranteed to village and regional corporations set up to manage the land and money has been conveyed. This program is the fourth in a 10-part series, The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, the First 10 Years. Agency representatives and Native corporation leaders will give their perspectives on the lands aspect of the land claim settlement.
Dividing the mock talk, it's the way it's always been. Dividing the mock talk between family and friends. We're sailing towards the future, we're anchored in the past. Rich in our tradition, our way.
The key to the land claims legislation was land. Nelson Ongapuk is the executive vice president of the Chilista Corporation, supervising lands and natural resource development. With 56 villages in southwest Alaska, Chilista has more than any other regional Native corporation, and Ongapuk supervises an area approximately the size of the state of Washington.
Land is something that has sustained us. Land was something that was essential to the survival of our people as the very air that we breathed for survival. And it was used in that manner. Land is our lifeline, because without land, we couldn't survive.
With ANCSA, that lifeline became a legal right, a change in effect from Aboriginal title to legal title. But explaining that change from land use to land ownership was no easy task. Nelson Ongapuk.
Prior to the passage of the Land Claim Settlement Act, that land had always been considered to be the land that's owned and used by all the people in our area. With the passage of the Land Claim Settlement Act, we were now told suddenly that we would have to select and apply for specific tracts of lands within the withdrawn lands that can be formally owned by the village corporations. And it was a concept that was relatively hard to convey to our villages because for a long time the people in our area were primarily land users and they used approximately 95% of the delta for subsistence and or survival purposes. Now all of a sudden they were told they couldn't own that whole land but a small portion of that land. It was a very tough battle, uphill battle, to convince them that they had to select that land.
And once selected, there were no guarantees of receipt. Dennis Tippelman of Kotzebue is the Alaska Federation of Natives, Washington, D.C. representative.
One of those big problems was that the 1959 Statehood Act gave the state of Alaska 103 million acres of land. And then the 1971 Act put a stop to the Alaska Statehood Act provisions, and in the end, maybe there was some same lands that both corporations wanted. The 71 Act kind of gave preference to the native corporations to make their selections first, and in the process created challenges, lawsuits, filing of the same lands, and so it became a complex conveyance procedure.
Bob Arnold is the Assistant State Director for Conveyance Management of the Department of the Interior's Bureau of Land Management. For the past 3 years, he has been overseeing the conveyance of lands to native corporations and to the state of Alaska.
Of the 40 million acres, 22 million acres of surface estate were to go to village corporations. The 22 million acres of subsurface estate would go to the 12 regional corporations in Alaska. An additional 16 million acres would go to six regional corporations, which claimed large areas of land, but whose population or enrollments to village corporations were low. Another 2 million acres would go under what we call miscellaneous grants provision to native groups, to native corporations in Juneau, Kenai, Sitka, and Kodiak, to persons who applied for allotments before the Native Allotment Act was revoked by the Claims Act, for cemetery sites and historic places, and for principal places of residence. Any part of that 2 million acres that did not go for these stated purposes would be distributed on the basis of enrollments to the 12 regional corporations. And though that doesn't seem like a lot would be left, it's been a very important provision, particularly for Sea Alaska, which had no part of the 16 million acres slated for itself. But another provision of the Act said that village corporations on revoked reserves could choose to take full title of surface and subsurface and opt out of the Act as far as the rest of its terms went, including the money payments. The villages of Elam, Savunga and Gamble on St. Lawrence Island, Venati and Arctic Village, which make up the Venati Reservation or Reserve, the people of Tetlin with the Tetlin Reserve. These, plus Klukwan, voted to take the reserve. Together, collectively, the aggregate acreage involved is 3.7 million acres, roughly. There was no place within the 40 million that the 3.7 million acres could come. As a result, the new total is 43.7 million acres. There are three principal streams of activity that must be accomplished. One is determination of which waterways are navigable before we convey to native corporations. A second stream of activity is easement identification. This is one of the things that makes the process of conveyance very, very slow, because there are opportunities for public nomination and public comment throughout. Now, that third stream of activity is the adjudication task. If the Land Claims Act had passed in 1868 instead of 1971, adjudication would be easy because, ignoring Indian title, it was all public domain. In the 100 years plus, 104 years, between the purchase of Alaska from Russia and the passage of the Act, however, lots of persons and organizations and government entities obtained rights or interests of one kind or another in the land. Homesteads, T&M sites, native allotments, rights of way, government installations, all of these have to be examined and adjudicated so that we can convey only what we own. So these three streams of activity put us at the edge of conveyancing. At that point, we prepare and furnish to the village and regional corporation affected a draft document. It's a draft title document. We called it a draft decision. We mail that to the village and offer to explain it and have their comments, whatever they are, before we publish. Because once we publish the decision, the only recourse for the corporation is to appeal that to the Alaska Native Claims Appeals Board. This takes time and money, and it really takes a lot of time.
Of course, charges have been levied that it's BLM that takes lots of time, so much time that Arnold predicts that all the land won't be conveyed for quite a while. His target is to convey 86% of the land by 1986.
I wonder why they used the words immediately convey if they knew anything about title transfer.
In the quiet, silent morning, on the first great white dawn, when the people walked on the frozen sea to a land of endless living, walk with me.
What happens when the public has been using land that now belongs to a Native corporation? That question has been posed in Juneau in a conflict between Gold Belt, the Juneau-based urban Native corporation, on one side, and the Bureau of Land Management on the other. Part of Gold Belt's land entitlement under the Native Claims Settlement Act is roughly 3,000 acres around Echo Cove, a sheltered inlet about 40 miles north of Juneau at the far end of the Dead End Highway. Echo Cove is a popular spot for fishermen and boaters, and it provides safe access to Berners Bay just north of Echo Cove. The BLM issued an easement to assure continued public access to Echo Cove across Gold Belt lands. That easement is a typical move by the BLM under its duty to guarantee access to public lands. Echo Cove itself remains in the public domain. But Gold Belt objects to that easement on grounds that a proposed boat launch facility envisioned by the borough and the Forest Service would be incompatible with Gold Belt's own future plans for residential development there. Gold Belt took its challenge of the easement to the Alaska Native Claims Appeals Board, which referred it to a hearing before a federal administrative law judge in early November.
Judy Brady is the administrative law judge of the Alaska Native Claims Appeal Board.
The kinds of cases we have dealt with are exactly the kinds of cases that the leadership of the Native regions and the state anticipated way back in 1971. They have to do with navigability of waterways, they have to do with easements, they have to do with the whole category of interests called valid existing rights. The Settlement Act started fencing off some land, and everybody started jumping up and down saying, hey, wait a minute, that's my land. And when people say, hey, wait a minute, that's my land, they come to us.
The Alaska Native Claims Appeal Board, ANCAB, has heard around 700 appeals in its 7 years of existence, a relatively small number given the quantity of land involved. The appeals have come from a mix of various sources, individuals, municipalities, and especially corporations and the state. With the passage of the Alaska National Interest Lands Conservation Act, also called ANILCA, the Alaska Lands Bill, and D2, there should be fewer cases for the Appeals Board. ANILCA is the second set of amendments to the Act, the first occurring in 1976. ANILCA, passed in December 1980, is a more than 150-page document with 49 amendments to the claim settlement, and those amendments, designed to strengthen and clarify the Act, are collectively about twice as long as the entire Act itself. Senator Ted Stevens, one of the prime movers for the claims settlement, was also instrumental in moving the D2 bill.
There were just changed circumstances in the Alaska Lands Act amendments to the Native Land Claims Settlement Act really took into account the passage of time and the impediments that had been discovered through that period of time to carrying out the original settlement.
Unlike stock in Native corporations, which cannot be sold until 1991, land, once it has been conveyed, can be sold, leased, or transferred to people within the corporation or to outsiders. There are no restrictions, as there are, at least to some extent, on stock. Emil Noddy, the first person to serve as president of the Alaska Federation of Natives and now president emeritus, hopes that people will hang on to the land.
In the long run, the future of the people is tied to the land, ownership of the land.
You've been listening to The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, The First 10 Years, the fourth program in a 10-part series written and produced by Karen Michelle McPherson with technical assistance from Phil Falkowski. Funding was provided by KUAC sponsors and the Alaska Native Human Resources Development Program of the Cooperative Extension Service of the University of Alaska. Special thanks to Tim Frakis, Patty Ginsburg, and musicians Herbie Vent, Buddy Tabor, and the Bethel Dancers. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5 from Educational Media Services, Star Route Box 20155, Fairbanks, Alaska 99701.
Ladies and gentlemen of the AFN, this is the White House in Washington calling. I present the President of the United States.
I appreciate this opportunity to extend my greetings and best wishes to the Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I want you to be among the first to know that I have just signed the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. This is a milestone in Alaska's history.
The corporate whale, ANCSA, the first 10 years.
The Reverend Merkulieff from St. George Island.
This land of Alaska, which thou gave to our ancestors, who had come and gone before us, is now being handed to us a second time by the act of the United States Congress and our untiring efforts. A second chance is given to us by thee to be the new custodians and caretakers.
Under the terms of the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act, ANCSA, the $962.5 million and nearly 44 million acres of land given in exchange for relinquishing Aboriginal land claims were to be distributed to eligible Alaska Natives, shareholders through business corporations. 12 regional profit-making corporations were mandated, arranged roughly along ethnic divisions, with the possibility of a 13th for Alaska Natives living outside the state. In addition, each of the more than 200 villages listed in the bill was required to form either profit or non-profit corporations. All chose the profit option. Inevitably, as with all businesses, some have been more profitable than others. Perhaps most remarkably, all have survived the 10 years since President Richard Nixon signed the Alaska Native Land Claim Settlement Act on December 18, 1971, defeating predictions that some, at least, would soon go bankrupt. Bering Straits Regional Corporation, based in Nome, nearly did in 1978 and continues to flounder. And the 13th Regional Corporation, headquartered in Seattle, Washington, recently discontinued nearly all operations. Debt payments were negotiated in order to avoid closure and attempt a turnaround from 1980 losses exceeding $9 million. But there are successes as well, big ones. Notably, Sea Alaska Corporation in Juneau, the first of the corporations established under ANCSA to make the Fortune 1000. In this program, the fifth in a 10-part series, The Corporate Whale, leaders of Sea Alaska and Cook Inlet Region Incorporated will profile their activities in dividing the benefits of ANCSA into profits for shareholders.
Dividing the mock talk, it's the way it's always been. Dividing the mock talk between family and friends. We're sailing towards the future, we're anchored in the past. Rich in our tradition, our way will surely last.
The Growth Star was a newcomer, Sea Alaska, number 951, a seafood products concern headquartered in Juneau, Alaska. Its sales soared 684% from $17.6 million in 1979 to $137.9 million last year. For several years, it dabbled cautiously in the transportation.
Fortune magazine, in its annual assessment of the corporate giants of the country, gave that report in the June 15, 1981 issue. Sea Alaska has more shareholders, close to 16,000 Tlingit, Haida, and Tsimshian Indians, and greater net worth, almost $200 million, than any of the 13 regional native corporations. The corporate office is located in its own high-rise building in the state capital, Juneau. In 1959, the Court of Claims awarded the Tlingit and Haida Indians a cash settlement for lands taken. ANCSA is a second land claim settlement. 12 villages are within the region, which is eligible to receive 280,000 acres of land in southeast Alaska, including timberlands in the Tongass National Forest. Byron Malott, a past president of the Alaska Federation of Natives and former state commissioner of community and regional affairs, is the chairman of the board.
See, Alaska had standing timber, a valuable asset that could be taken to market very quickly. Having 16,000 shareholders under the formulas of ANCSA, we got the largest chunk of cash. And so Sea Alaska had a real opportunity to marshal and utilize its assets quickly that most other Native corporations didn't.
Past president of the Alaska Federation of Natives, current president of the Alaska Native Foundation, and Sea Alaska board member Roger Lang.
We happen to be in fish and timber, and there's no conjecture about timber. Damn things are standing there. You don't have to wonder how many trees you got. You can go out there with a counter and count them, you know. And it's a resource that can be marketed and developed quickly. It's not like oil, gas, or gold, or any of the, either, any of the subsurface minerals. So our resources are visible, easy to get to, and easy to get into business with, build roads and cut trees.
There are other business operations besides Sea Alaska Timber Corporation and Ocean Beauty Seafoods. Sea Alaska also owns or has interests in Alaska Brick Company, United Bank Alaska, a wholly Native-owned bank, Sea Alaska Business Investment Corporation, and a 1% interest in Beaufort Sea oil and gas leases in conjunction with Sohio BP and three other Native corporations. But profits aren't the only motives. Roger Lang.
No, there's many more factors enter into what we do than pure motive. Pure profit. If, for instance, Sea Alaska wanted to be purely a profit mode, it would have nothing at all to do with fish, and we got $58 million tied up in that end. It just happens to be something that our people are good at, that our people can work in, and that kind of stuff. That's a large part of what we did.
But as in any corporation, there are disgruntled shareholders who would prefer less altruism and more cash in the form of dividends. Sitka Community Association Executive Director, Sciatica Corporation Director, and Sea Alaska Shareholder Andy Hope III.
They didn't give out any of it out in dividends. You know, I see Cook Inlet made $5.7 million profit last year, and they gave $900,000 of that as dividends. Sea Alaska made $5.9 million, it gave zilch.
Shareholder Marietta Williams.
These things that they have going, like the brick company, and are we really getting things out of this? Are we really going to get something out of those things eventually?
According to Malott, people are getting a great deal now. Sea Alaska's developments tend to impact village lands, and rather than proceed in a manner that may be cost-effective but environmentally destructive, Sea Alaska chooses to spend more money and minimize the negative effects of, say, timber harvesting.
You know, if you're a Native corporation, you come down on the side of the Native, even if it does impact your bottom line. Sea Alaska is trying to be the kind of business corporation that can be utilized as a tool by our shareholders as Native people. Native people still have not been able to grasp the brass ring of the American merry-go-round. And that's what we're setting out to do.
Close behind Sea Alaska in terms of profitability is the Cook Inlet Region Incorporated. Located in an architecturally commanding building it owns near downtown Anchorage, the state's largest city, SERI, as it's called, has a set of amendments to ANCSA devoted to its particular land needs. Cook Inlet Region Incorporated 6,300 shareholders are primarily urban residents, though some live in villages and other sites nearby. In 1980, SERI's net worth was a bit over $46 million, and net profits for that year were $5.7 million, up from $3.4 million the year before, a year that corporation led all others created under ANCSA. Roy Hundorf has been president since 1975.
Our geographic area is the south central part of Alaska. The land entitlement of the region and its villages is approximately 2.3 million acres. We have seven villages, each entitled to some of the surface estate, essentially about a million of the surface acres of the 2.3 million acres are part of the village entitlement.
Only 1,500 of Ceres shareholders live in villages and are enrolled in village corporations. The rest are so-called at-large and receive payments from the settlement directly rather than having them diverted to village corporations. Ceres shareholders, being primarily urban, are also less inclined to urge corporate leadership to get involved in the subsistence issue or feel as strongly about the balance between resource development on corporate lands versus its impact on traditional lifestyle.
We're going to be careful and we're worried about how their land is used, but we have slightly different priorities. For example, it's quite likely that Siri might develop a mineral resource on its land before another region might develop a mineral resource on village land in rural Alaska. And this is because the village will no doubt be consulted, and they may have some objections to bringing development into their subsistence area. Here we don't see much of that kind of a conflict.
A large measure of Cook Inlet's conflicts have centered on the land, on getting the ANCSA entitlement.
In our case, unlike other regional corporations, much of the land that was prescribed for the villages and the region had already been patented to the state and was therefore not available for selection by us. So therefore, we were thrown into this category of discretion that the secretary had, and he would, as the act requires, withdraw land of similar kind and character from which we would select our entitlement. And of course, we disagreed with how he exercised that discretion. We ultimately went to court. And we settled out of court by engaging in a three-way land exchange, the state, the federal government, and Siri in 1976. It was challenged in court subsequently. It cleared the courts in late 1978, and we have been in the process of implementing the exchange since then.
Instead of the unacceptable, inaccessible mountaintops and glaciers, Siri Holdings now includes surplus federal property in the southeast and in the interior, subsurface lands in the Kenai Moose Range with good coal, oil and gas potential, and the Beluga coal fields.
Siri is primarily a natural resource company, that is, an energy and minerals company. We have broadened that definition of the corporation's business somewhat by adding that we are in the business of energy and minerals and service industries that are attendant to the development of these resources, such as oil and gas drilling, engineering and design of remote energy-related facilities. We've recently become involved in specialized pipeline construction, plus resource development, are our main areas of interest. Additionally, the fourth area is naturally real estate. We have some commercial real estate, and that is a part of our portfolio. But of course, the real profit, the real cash flow from mineral development will come if development of a mine occurs and you begin to get production payments, or development continues and expands in oil and gas, in the area of oil and gas and coal.
Next year, Roy Hundorf expects Cook Inlet Region Incorporated's profits to top $10 million, and shareholders can anticipate dividends.
I think this is the net, the end result of those early decisions. There's been a number of correct decisions made by people at Syria since the act passed in 1971, and a lot of luck. A lot of luck rolled into it. We're located right in South Central Alaska, where the majority of the people live, and therefore the bulk of the economy is, and we should be expected to do better than the average corporation, I suppose.
You've been listening to The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, The First 10 Years, the fifth program in a 10-part series written and produced by Karen Michelle McPherson with technical assistance from Phil Falkowski. Funding was provided by KUAC sponsors and the Alaska Native Human Resources Development Program of the Cooperative Extension Service of the University of Alaska. Special thanks to David Harding, John Neustrom and Kathy Cody of KCAW, Patty Ginsburg of KTOO, and musicians Herbie Vent, Buddy Tabor, the Gajaheen Dancers, and Will Ackerman. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5 from Educational Media Services, Star Route Box 20155, Fairbanks, Alaska 99701.
Ladies and gentlemen of the AFN, this is the White House in Washington calling. I present the President of the United States.
I appreciate this opportunity to extend my greetings and best wishes to the Convention of the Alaska Federation of Natives. I want you to be among the first to know that I have just signed the Alaska Native Claim Settlement Act. This is a milestone in Alaska's history.
The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, The First 10 Years.
The Reverend Merkulieff from St. George Island.
This land of Alaska, which thou gave to our ancestors who had come and gone before us, is now being handed to us a second time by the act of the United States Congress and our untiring efforts. A second chance is given to us by thee to be the new custodians and caretakers.
Of the 13 regional Native corporations the Alaska Native Land Claims Settlement Act created to be overseers of the Act's benefits, some have taken better care than others of their share of Congress's grant. Nearly $1 billion and close to 44 million acres of land given in exchange for relinquishing further land claims. In the 10 years since President Richard Nixon signed the act, ANCSA, into law on December 18, 1971, millions of dollars have been made and even more millions lost, implementing the act and the business structure it mandates, business corporations that differ from the usual in a number of ways. They are overseen by both the state and the Secretary of the Interior. Shareholders are determined by enrollment and receive equal numbers of shares, which they may not sell for 20 years. Identifying and obtaining land is a major activity, and the initial capital, now all received, came from Congress and the state of Alaska, not private investors, a fact that caused some delay in starting up the new business enterprises. John Schaefer first became president of Nana Regional Corporation in Kotzebue in 1972.
We had an act, but no money.
That situation has changed due to the receipt of the cash part of the land claim settlement, and for some corporations as a result of prudent investments. In 1980, net worth for the 13 regional corporations ranged from Sea Alaska's close to $200 million down to Chugach's $7 million, the only corporation that has not yet received any of its land entitlement. The profits and losses vary widely as well, from Sea Alaska and Cook Inlet region at the top, with profits close to $6 million each, to Chulista Corporation's 1980 losses in excess of $7 million. In this program, the sixth in a 10-part series, The Corporate Whale, leaders from NANA, the Northwest Alaska Native Association region, and Chulista Corporation will profile their corporation's activities in managing ANCSA's benefits.
Dividing the mock talk, it's the way it's always been. Dividing. towards a future or anchored in the past. Rich in our tradition, our way will surely last.
Balancing the traditions of the Inupiaq Eskimo people of the Northwest Arctic with making profits is a major concern for NANA, the Northwest Alaska Native Regional Corporation based in Kotzebue. Willie Hensley, who first organized NANA in 1966, is now president of NANA Development Corporation.
Of what real value is it to work for a Native corporation unless you feel that you're helping contribute to their willingness to survive as a people? You know, otherwise you can go to work for Exxon or, you know, some other corporation.
NANA president John Schaefer.
Profit is not a great motive. We look at other things, providing jobs essentially, or providing services, and then if we can make it a profit on it, we will. And but usually we look for a longer period of time before we get our investment back.
Investments are basically of two types: what Schaefer calls regional efforts, designed to provide services and jobs to the region's 11 villages and 5,000 shareholders, investments such as reindeer herds that provide jobs, meat, and the sale of antlers to the Far East for use in medicines, fuel depots, a building supply store, a museum, hotels, a seafood processing plant, and a jade manufacturing firm that uses jade mined locally but carved in the Far East to look like Eskimo carvings. Those regional investments are balanced with what are referred to as statewide efforts managed from Anchorage. They are seen as strictly business, as profit-making ventures.
Our biggest investment is in the oil field service area. We have a camp at Prudhoe Bay. We have a security company that does most of its work up there. We have catering operations. We have a construction firm that works around the state. And recently, a company that we own a part of that's a drilling company that owns drill rigs that work on the slope. We own a small portion of some leases on the slope.
There is more development on the Arctic slope than on NANA's own lands, 1,900,000 acres of surface and subsurface entitlement, plus subsurface rights on another 365,000 acres. One in-region development is a lead-zinc mine, which will impact caribou migration.
That even has a greater conflict than any oil development might have, a more direct conflict with the way our people live. But we brought the question to our people and basically told them what environmental considerations they should have and what changes that they should expect in their lifestyle. And they said, we can't live anymore on just the land alone. We've got to have cash too. We need the jobs. Go and develop the mine. So we're busily developing a mine that's in direct conflict with our way of life, but at the insistence of our shareholders.
Shareholders that have received dividends since 1979 from a corporation that showed a bit over $200,000 in profits for 1980, down from $636,000 the year before, and a 1980 net worth of $44 million, a corporation that actively seeks to preserve what Hensley and Schaefer call the spirit of the people, while still maintaining the profitability of the people's corporation.
We don't consider NANA being different than the people in the villages. NANA is made up of the people, and our goals are for all of the people.
The Chilista Corporation has the second largest money entitlement of all Alaska Native Regional Corporations, $165 million, a 1980 net worth of nearly $60 million, second only to Sea Alaska. It's second again to Sea Alaska in number of shareholders, 13,500, second in land entitlement after Doyon Limited, and first in number of villages it oversees, and in losses, more than $7 million last year. Nelson Angapak is Calista's executive vice president and chairman of the board.
Calista Corporation is a region that's located in southwest Alaska, starting from Lime Village on down to Platinum, going along the coastal areas up to Kotlik, going along both riverine areas, Kuskokwim up to Stony River, and up to Lime Village, on the Yukon River up to Russian Mission Yukon, covering approximately 56,000 square miles. We have 56 villages scattered in an area that's about the size of the state of Washington.
The Calista region's land entitlement is nearly 7 million acres, and Angapak feels that getting title to all of it will be a big headache, partly because one-third of all land in the region is submerged and partly due to the quantity.
Thinking very optimistically, you're looking at approximately 150 years until such time all of the entitlements of the village corporations and or Calista Corporation are conveyed to us.
Obtaining the land, however, has not been Calista's biggest headache. Investing wisely has. In Yupik Eskimo, Calista means the worker. Finding the right workers, competent managers, has evaded the corporation, which has had better than half a dozen chief executive officers since 1973. All were from the region.
It was very difficult on our part to finally recognize the fact that we needed a professional businessman to head a company as complex as Calista Corporation. And when we came to that realization, we swallowed some of our pride.
We raised a lot of hell is what we did.
Bev Hoffman of Bethel is an active member of a group calling themselves the Concerned Shareholders, a group instrumental in ousting the former management.
My sister's in Cook Inlet, right, and she gets all these wonderful checks, and Southeastern is their Native corporation's doing real good, and it makes you wonder, well, why isn't our corporation doing real good?
The challenge is there, I think, and I'm somewhat bullish in that, that my expertise in all the various fields that the Calista Corporation is involved in will serve them well.
Alex Rader, a Canadian attorney, came on board as Calista's president in mid-1981 and busied himself divesting Calista of some of its losing investments, including travel agencies, a pier in Seattle that previous management intended to develop into a tourist facility and shopping center, and a geophysical subsidiary, which Calista sold to a village corporation in the region. None of the corporation's investments are in Bethel, the area's regional center, nor are the corporate offices, a frequent criticism. But at the moment, all of the investments are in state.
We own the Sheraton Hotel in the city of Anchorage. We have a major project in Wasilla called Settlers Bay Village, which is a land and residential development. And we are also involved in the fishing industry under the name of Calista Fisheries. We think the hotel is a good investment, but one understands that a hotel doesn't turn itself around in a day. It's a long-range investment and will prove to be a very profitable one for the company. Calista Fisheries has made money consistently. Settlers Bay has had a shaky start, but that is going to be turned around, and that will also become a very successful profit center for the company. These are the three main assets we have at this particular moment, in addition to our development of natural resources, which is a future item.
Nelson Angapak.
Calista Corporation has made some mistakes when we made our financial decisions. That's a fact, and I'll be the first to admit that fact. But with the new leadership that we have, those mistakes that we have made in the past are being corrected. And it took us something like 6 years to make those mistakes. It will take some time to correct those mistakes, but I would think that all the corrections necessary to make this company into a profit-making corporation have already begun.
Calista President Alex Rader.
We will be successful. There's no doubt about that.
You've been listening to The Corporate Whale, ANCSA, the First 10 Years, the sixth program in a 10-part series written and produced by Karen Michelle McPherson with technical assistance from Phil Falkowski. Funding was provided by KUAC sponsors and the Alaska Native Human Resources Development Program of the Cooperative Extension Service of the University of Alaska. Special thanks to KYUK and musicians Herbie Vent, Buddy Tabor, the Kotzebue Northern Lights Dancers, and John Angayak. Cassette copies of this program are available for $5 from Educational Media Services, Starroot Box 20155, Fairbanks, Alaska 99701.